Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Jonathan Derbyshire. I'm Executive Opinion Editor at the Financial Times. And I'm delighted to welcome you all to today's special lunchtime event. I'm really delighted to be joined today by Amitav Ghosh, an internationally acclaimed author of several novels, as well as works of non-fiction. He's sold several million books worldwide, translated into over 30 languages, and he's been shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. His work explores a vast number of global issues throughout history, and his latest novel, Gun Island, from which he's going to read in a moment, is no different. It looks at the ramifications of our changing climate and the condition of humanity in the era of the Anthropocene. So what responsibilities do writers have to reflect reality and help us understand our place in the world? And how can fiction be perhaps a force for good in facing up to the fact of climate change? Amitav will begin with a reading from the new novel, Gun Island, and then he and I will talk for 20 or 25 minutes, leaving you plenty of time for your questions before we wrap up at 2 o'clock. So please, let's get started, and first join me in welcoming Amitav Ghosh.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here, and thank you, Jonathan, for that very nice introduction. So I'm just going to read to you a few paragraphs right from the beginning of the book, so I don't need to explain anything before I start. The strangest thing about this strange journey was that it was launched by a word, and not an unusually resonant one either, but a banal, commonplace coinage that is in wide circulation from Cairo to Calcutta. That word is bandook, which means gun in many languages, including my own mother tongue, Bengali or Bangla. Nor is the word a stranger to English. By way of British colonial usages, the word bandook found its way into the Oxford English Dictionary, where it's glossed as rifle. But there was no rifle or gun in sight the day the journey began. Nor indeed was the word intended to refer to a weapon. And that precisely was why it caught my attention, because the gun in question was a part of a name, Bunduki Shodagor, which could be translated as the gun merchant. The gun merchant entered my life not in Brooklyn, where I live and work, but in the city where I was born and raised, Calcutta, or Kolkata, as it is now formally known. That year, as on many others, I was in Kolkata through much of the winter, ostensibly for business. My work as a dealer in rare books and Asian antiquities requires me to do a good deal of on-site scouting. And since I happen to possess a small apartment in Kolkata, the city has become a second base of operations for me. The day of my return to Brooklyn was almost at hand when I went to the last of my social engagements of the season, the wedding reception of a cousin's daughter. I had just entered the venue, a stuffy colonial era club, when I was accosted by a distant relative, Kanai Dutt. I had not seen Kanai in many years, which was not entirely a matter of regret for me. He had always been a glib, vain, precocious know-it-all who relied on his quick tongue and good looks to charm women and get ahead in the world. "Tell me, Dinu," he said after a cursory handshake, "is it true that you've set yourself up as an expert on Bengali folklore?" The almost audible sneer rattled me. "Well," I spluttered, "I did some research on that kind of thing a long time ago, but I gave it up when I left academia and became a book dealer." "But you did get a PhD, didn't you?" he said with barely concealed derision. "So you are technically an expert." "I would hardly call myself that." He cut me short without apology. "So tell me then, Mr. Expert," he said, "have you heard of a figure called Bunduki Shodagor?" He had clearly been intending to surprise me, and he succeeded. The name Bunduki Shodagor, or gun merchant, was so new to me that I was tempted to think that Kanai had made it up. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Amitav. So this... Thank you, figure of the gun merchant is a figure of traditional Indian folklore?
Not Indian. It's very specific to the region that I'm
Bengali.
From. But not just Bengali, I would say Eastern India, because it also figures in Assamese. There's a huge overlap of cultures within Eastern India, but it's very much, the merchant figure is very much a figure of East Indian folklore, Eastern Indian folklore.
So the frame for this discussion is fiction and the fact of climate change. So this is, in one way or another, a novel about climate change, or that is an attempt to face up to the fact of climate change. So perhaps you could tell us a bit about the relationship between this folkloric figure of the gun merchant and the wider context in which the novel unfolds.
I wouldn't at all say that it's a novel about climate change, really. I think it's a novel about the world that we're in. You know, a novel about the world that we're in, most of all the world that I am in, as someone from Bengal. As I'm sure all of you know, Bengal is, most of it is less than 1 meter above sea level. Actually, the city I'm from, Kolkata, is below sea level. So, you know, this is a novel about the real world. It's about the world we live in. So in that sense, I would say it's not a novel with any kind of propaganda agenda or anything like that. I think any novel which sets out to have that kind of agenda would be the purpose would be defeated, you know, before it began. So, you know, I take quite seriously the idea that, writers, artists have always reflected the realities that are around them. But I think in the last, 20, 30 years, exactly as greenhouse gases were accelerating, really the arts have turned away from, contending with the reality that is actually unfolding around us. And one reason may be because, on the whole, artists and writers and so on tend to be from urban, fairly privileged literary classes. So they don't see, the ways in which these impacts are really affecting the world. So that's the first thing I would say, that this is a novel about the world that we live in. It's not about the future, absolutely not. It's not about dystopias or, all the things we've come to associate with a certain.
But you would probably want to say that an, if not the inescapable fact about the current moment is the climate emergency.
Absolutely. That is absolutely the case. And I don't think one needs a special genre, as it were, to, reflect that reality. I think the reality that we need to reflect is the reality that we see. And, since this is the Royal Society for for the Arts, I think that, to me, is the real conundrum, I mean, for example, I was in New York in 9/11 when it was hit, the day it happened, I said to myself, oh, my God, now for years to come, I'm going to have to read books about, what I'm seeing in front of me today. And that was the case, novel after novel after novel, not to speak of all the nonfiction, etc. Then there was Hurricane Sandy. And when that happened, I thought to myself, am I going to read any books about Hurricane Sandy? And Hurricane Sandy devastated New York. New York is, as you all know, filled with writers and artists. It teems with writers and artists. One of the areas that was most badly hit was Chelsea, which is just, filled with, art galleries, etc. Since then, have I read a single novel about Hurricane Sandy? No. I have read, there are novels, actually more and more of them, about New York being drowned in some future. But the real drowning of New York doesn't feature at all, how can we escape the fact that there is a question here? That this poses to us some question. New York, let's talk also about Mumbai. Bombay, it's a city, again, which has been repeatedly hit by these climate events in recent years. Basically, it's been hit by these rain bomb events, stalled weather systems dumping enormous quantities of rain in sudden bursts. One of these happened, I think it was 2008 or 5, I forget exactly, but some 10 years ago. The city came to an absolute standstill. Many, many people died, and people had traumatic experiences, They were separated from their children for days. They didn't know how to reach their children. Again, Mumbai is filled with artists, filmmakers. They make films about everything that happens. But are there any films about these floods? No. In fact, quite recently, I met some friends in Mumbai, very celebrated artists, a couple. They had a terrible, terrible experience. They were separated from their daughter, couldn't get through to her. And they said to me, oh, you know, I had a really traumatic experience during these floods. So I said, has this trauma in any way showed itself in your work? And they looked at me, completely astonished. they couldn't believe that I'd even asked this question. Why? Because in art today, the very idea that you might be doing something that reflects what is around you is something that's really looked down upon. Mm. It's marginalized as illustrative.
Although you were quite strikingly resistant when I suggested to my suggestion that this was a climate change novel, the implication of your answer was that, no, this is not didactic. So I want to push at two questions. One is the question of why the contemporary novel, and I think we're talking about the literary novel in particular, why the contemporary literary novel is so resistant to grappling with the fact of climate change. But I think arguably that question is a subset of a broader question about politics in the novel itself. There's a famous remark of Stendhal's, which you may remember, which I thought it might be useful just to read. He wrote, this is in the mid-19th century, politics in a literary work is a pistol shot in the middle of a concert, a rather coarse matter, but on the other hand, something which one ignores at one's own peril. So there's a tension or a paradox there. But it does suggest that politics has always been a problem for the novel as a form. It's always been a troublesome house guest. Does that resonate with you at all?
There are many questions there. The first is the one about didacticism. That's a complicated question. And as I say, really for me, what is interesting about the world of art, or the arts, if you like, is that it has always reflected the circumstances that people live in. So, for example, if you go back to cave paintings, what do you see? You see the mammoths, you see the horses, you see the animals, and so on. Similarly, if you, you go back even to, let's say, Pharaonic art, that's what you see. You see how people made things, how they did things. So why is it that today we've become removed, from the realities that surround us? And I think that does pose a question. Secondly, the question of politics. It may seem, the modern novel did this sort of conjuring trick where it sort of pretended to remove politics. But really, E.M. Forster's work was in some sense very political, Similarly, George Orwell was always intensely political. I'm just now speaking of British writers. But if I think back to, let's say, the sort of English writing that we were exposed to, in India, who were the great novelists of that time? Who were the novelists whose books were readily available to us? They were people like, let's say, Angus Wilson. Does any young person today even know that name?
I suspect not,
yes. But in that sense, he wasn't writing about politics as such. But the very fact of the presence of that book in such an overwhelming form reflected the politics of the age, So, that politics has always been there in a sense,
So you said earlier that how struck you've been by the near absence of climate change as a theme, for want of a better word, in contemporary literary fiction, that it has an even smaller presence than it does there than it does in public discourse. Now, this was the theme of a book you wrote in 2016 called The Great Derangement, Climate Change and the Unthinkable. So can we try and unpack the... So we've asserted that climate change doesn't really figure in the contemporary literary novel. So then the next question is why that is. What is it? So, and then that has two parts, that question. What is it about the novel, and what is it about climate change or the climate emergency, whatever you want to call it, that makes it, as it were, unassimilable for the contemporary literary novel?
Well, first, I must say that this book, The Great Derangement, many people say to me, oh, you're castigating the world of other writers and so on. And I really explicitly want to say that I'm not castigating anyone. I don't think it's my business to tell people what they should write or how they should write. The book really began, these essays began as an interrogation of myself and actually of my own practices, you know. So I'll tell you an anecdote about, how this book starts. Many years ago, when I was in my early 20s, in 1978, in fact, I was a student at Delhi University, and I was one day sitting in the library, studying or something. And the weather became very strange, weird sort of gray clouds. In Delhi at that time of the year, it's generally just very hot, and cloudless. But it became very strange and, suddenly hail, which is very rare in Delhi. So I decided to leave the library, and I started walking. And I decided somehow to go and visit a friend who lived in a sort of out-of-the-way place, for me, out-of-the-way. So I took a road I never normally took. So I started going down this road. I saw my friend, and the weather got even worse. So then I came out and decided to go back to the hostel that I was living in. And as I stepped out on this road, I heard this strange sound, a sort of rumbling sound. And I looked up, and there was this gray cloud in the sky. And as I was looking, a strange finger came out of this cloud, a sort of spinning finger, and it came straight down, and I could see it coming straight towards me, And it was so weird. Today, anybody would probably stop to take a selfie, but, my animal instincts kicked in, so I ran to take shelter, and I took shelter. There was a sort of big university building with a glass door, and I ran there. Other people were sheltering there. So I ran around and sort of crouched down in a little sheltered balcony. And a moment later, I looked up, and there was this absolutely surreal scene of, scooters and bicycles and entire tea stalls sort of hurtling past me, It was completely dark, this roaring sound, and it all lasted for a few seconds. And then this thing moved away, and it stayed down. It stayed connected to that one road for about another 10 seconds or so, and then it flashed up and disappeared. And so I got out of this little sheltered balcony and went around to that glass door. The door had shattered. The people who were there were terribly hurt. All around us, there were people who were wounded, people had died, dozens of people died. Entire walls had been ripped out of colleges. In India, we have ceiling fans, and the ceiling fans had turned out, into like tulips, like this. So it was astonishing to see. And then it turned out that this was the only tornado in recorded history to hit Delhi, These phenomena just don't occur in that part of India, but it occurred, and it only went for like 1 mile. And I, that day, at that moment, happened to be in that 1 mile, on a road that I would normally never be on. So, I'm a novelist. What we do is we mine our own experiences. And for years afterwards, in every book I wrote, I thought, I will place this, I'll find a place for this tornado. But every time I tried, it was impossible. It was completely impossible. Why? Because, within the form of a novel, it just seems too improbable. You have a character walking down the road and suddenly, this thing happens. Which reviewer is going to believe it? They'll say, oh, it's coincidence. This book is not believable. It's implausible. So that got me thinking, you know, about probability and the novel and the part that probability plays in the novel. And really what you see is that from the late 18th century onwards, as the novel becomes a sort of an important cultural force, what it does is that plausibility becomes increasingly important for it. Mm. So the improbableness of life is just constantly suppressed within the novel. So, you know, for example, Flaubert always says that the thing about nature, I mean, Emma Bovary says, nature is so boring, it's so predictable. She loves romance because romance is unpredictable, you know. And this was, of course, also the time of these geological theories of, you know, uniformism and so on, that everything always happens in the same way for forever and forever. So it was a 19th century mindset that emerged. So where are we now? Today we are in an age of, in a completely different age. I mean, the most startling thing about climate change is its improbability. Mm. These events that occur are so utterly improbable, the things that are happening all around us. These mysterious wildfires that suddenly come, break upon you. You know, at 9 in the morning, everything looks fine. Within half an hour, you know, every exit from town is burning, and you're sitting in a car, probably burning yourself. So, you know, how do we start grappling with that? How do we start grappling with this reality? And I think that is actually one of the ways in which climate change resists the novel. I wouldn't say it defeats the novel, but it resists it, you know, because as novelists, we sort of learn to write in ways that are plausible.
And it's the it's precisely the unthinkable scale of this catastrophe that's looming which defeats you and defeats the novel's rather exacting and attenuated notion of plausibility and...
Exactly, and that's a very good point. I mean, as you say, it's the scale. The other problem is scale. What do we love novels for? When they conjure up a sense of place. You know, that's been the sort of great project of the novel from the 19th century onwards, you know. Why do so many novels actually have place names as their that famous novel, 19th century novel, you know, Cranford. Yes, or Middlemarch. Mm. And I mean, all these novels are really just place names, you know. Why? Because we love to go, when a novelist writes a book about a place, they're inviting us in, they're inviting us to inhabit this place. But, you know, we no longer live in that world. I mean, all these kinds of phenomena are unfolding on a global scale, put in place by impacts that are not localized.
And we're having to change our understanding of the relationship between us as a species and the planet.
Exactly.
The planet we inhabit. So if you think of the 19th century novel and the contemporary literary novel is a recognizably a descendant of the 19th century novel, that is a form that deals in traffics in human relations. Yeah. We are now about to enter the age known as the Anthropocene. Everyone in the audience this week will have seen that the Anthropocene Working Group last week voted in favour of making the term an officially defined geological unit within the official geological timescale. So this is an era in which human beings are becoming geological agents. So at the very least, that does something to the novel and to culture and the arts and the humanities in general. I mean, it also completely transforms our sense of what it is to be a human being and the power we retain over the planet we inhabit.
That's absolutely true. I think I think this Anthropocene Working Group is it's doing something very, very important. We can all sense around us that you know, we are not at home. You know, the world is not what we were brought up to expect. It's something else. It's become something completely different. I mean, you know, all those Victorian ladies who would go to India and find it so hot. You know, they were fainting constantly, you know, on their way to tiffin and so on. I mean, now, if you look at, there have been so many days when it's hotter in England than it is in Goa, where, you know, I spend my time. And I often want to just note those days, you know, because what do you do with that entire construct, you know? So, yes, I think this whole Anthropocene thing is so interesting because, you know, it places the human at its center, but the irony of it is that what we are beginning to realize in the Anthropocene is that we are not the only actors. There are other actors who are making our history, who we've made history with together. So it was at the cost of suppressing our awareness of these other actors that we produced, as it were, you know, the Anthropocene, if you like, because you look back. You look back to pre-modern literature, to pre-modern art. Pre-modern literature, especially, is filled with non-human voices. In every tradition, including the European, you go back to the Iliad and the Odyssey. The Iliad is filled with non-human voices. You know, gods, the sea speaks, there's Laocoon, and there are the snakes, and, you know, there's all of that, you know. How does that awareness of the voice, of the agency of the non-human become suppressed? And to me, this is the central literary problem. You know, other people doing other things will find other aspects of the challenges in the Anthropocene. For me as a writer, the central literary problem of our era is really, how do we give voices to the non-human? How do we restore the voices of the non-human?
Because one of the points you make in The Great Derangement is that the literary novel, because it's circumscribed by a notion of probability in the way you've described, banishes the inhuman and the unthinkable to marginal genres, whether it's the gothic or the horror novel, fantasy or science fiction. But you want to wrench it back into somehow, see if you can wrench it back into the literary novel. It might mean wrenching the novel open and turning it into something we don't really recognize yet.
It's very important to recognize that, you know, I mean, these issues have been confronted by writers since the beginning of, you know, the novel as a form. I love, actually, I mean, there's Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, you know, which when Frankenstein came out, nobody thought of it as a genre novel. You know, Sir Walter Scott said he liked it better than any of his own novels, you know. She had an absolutely rapturous reception. It wasn't as if anyone said, oh, this is a fantasy, this is a, this is some gothic horror. And I actually love the story of how Frankenstein came to be written. Do you all know the story? It was actually caused by a climate event, you know, because there was the Mount Tambora explosion, a volcano in, I think it's near Sumatra. It exploded in 1815, and it spewed so much dust into the air that for a year afterwards, it completely changed global climate. So it was called the year without the year without a summer. People starved. There were no harvests. I mean, it just caused incredible climate disruption. They say the first great typhoid epidemics were also kicked off by this event. But that year, Lord Byron decided to go to Lake Geneva because he was fleeing his various scandals. And on arriving there, he found that Mary Shelley and Percy Shelley and so on were his neighbors. So one day, when the weather turned really, really bad, he said to everyone, let's all sit down and write something gothic or something, some scary thing about what we are seeing. And that was when Mary Shelley had the idea for Frankenstein. On that same day, Lord Byron invented the idea of the vampire, which his secretary then went on to take into the world. So, you know, it's curious, this form of the non-human, these forms of the non-human are very much with us today. I mean, if you open any list of best-selling books, or most popular movies, what's on top? It's superhumans, vampires, you know, hobgoblins of various kinds, and, you know, all that stuff. So an awareness of non-human voices is with us, whether we like it or not. It's just that we've chosen to say that it isn't serious, that it's somehow fantasy.
I mean, there have been, you'd think, prophetic figures throughout literary history. I think of J.G. Ballard, for example.
Very much.
Who wrote a novel called The Drowned World, which is a great climate catastrophe novel.
Absolutely.
In the mid-70s, but he was always a slightly marginal figure regarded as doing science fiction, not really doing serious literature.
Also history. I mean, his great book is The Siege of Krishnapur, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It's I mean, that book really holds up. But, you know, if you read it, have you read it?
Not for a long time, but I have read it.
The Drowned City? Yeah, I read it recently. It has dated terribly, because actually you can see it was written in the 70s, I think. And his idea of what happens is basically a kind of almost Victorian kind of Krishnapur thing, where these sort of colonial administrators or their equivalents are sort of having tea while the waters rise around them. And, you know, it's kind of, it's very different from the realities that we are actually experiencing.
One of the final chapter of The Great Derangement is entitled simply Politics. And it's a critique of a particular way of treating the climate catastrophe, specifically as a moral problem rather than a political one. Could you say a bit about that?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, you know, what does this word moral mean? What has it come to mean, really? And whenever you see this word being deployed publicly, it almost always means it's become, how shall I say, an effect of a kind of neoliberal thinking. You know, that everything is reducible to individual choices, individual decisions, individual sort of ethical approaches, or whatever you might call it, rather than seeing things collectively. So really, as soon as people start talking about the morality of climate change and so on, you know, what happens? Everybody starts thinking, oh my goodness, if only you know, I bicycle to work rather than taking a car and so on. And of course, those things are important, but they account for really completely fractional amounts of greenhouse gas emissions. Obviously, what we need is some sort of collective response, some sort of collective form of politics. And that's why I think this Extinction Rebellion and Greta Thunberg are so important. You know, I mean, they constantly highlight that it's not enough, you know, to make these, you know, changing light bulbs is not going to solve this issue. You know, in the first place, the issue that never comes up when climate change is reduced to this question of the personal footprint, you'll see, if you look on the internet, you'll see that dozens of representations of personal footprints, you know, expenditure on cars, expenditures on travel, food, etc. What is completely excluded or silenced is that 25% of, and it's a rising fraction, of greenhouse gas emissions comes from military exercises, uses, one quarter, you know, of greenhouse gas emissions. The largest single emitter, you know, the entity responsible for the largest set of emissions is the Pentagon. And that probably won't be the case for much longer, with Russia, China, et cetera, catching up very fast. So, you know, all the light bulbs you want to change will not make a difference until we start looking at the broader scale problems. And, you know, there's another trap to this whole light bulb changing approach, because it allows the climate denier to say, well, to make it a question of how does Al Gore live, you know, which is not the issue at all.
So to treat climate change as a political problem then is to treat it as a collective action problem, and it follows from that the solutions are not going to happen at a national level but at a global level. And in all your writing about climate change, you've been particularly interested in the relationship between Asia and the developed world, haven't you? And the action in this novel takes place across continents too. You wrote in The Great Derangement, for example, the continent of Asia is conceptually critical to every aspect of global warming. What do you mean by that?
Well, see, really what... half the greenhouse gases that are now in the atmosphere have been released within the lifetime of almost everyone here, that is starting in 1990. What does this coincide with? It's really the liberalization of the Indian economy, the changes in direction of the Chinese economy, of the Indonesian economy. So it's really this period, post-1989, that is responsible for this enormous surge in greenhouse gas emissions. So what has actually happened? It's that a large number of Asians have changed their carbon footprint by very little, so that their per capita carbon footprint is still fractional compared to Westerners, you know? But a very small change of that kind, simply because of the numbers involved, has created, put an enormous amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. So it's in that sense that Asia is absolutely crucial. Because, I know Westerners always think that history always happens here, but the reality is that this issue is not going to be decided over here. It's really going to be decided in Asia, So we can never forget that. And, I think we do forget it, We have to remember that that's where the main problem lies. And why is it a problem? Ultimately, as one of the IPCC people said, really climate change is in the end a problem of justice, because Asians are expanding their climate footprint. Why? Because their idea of the good life is now the sorts of lives that Westerners live.
Mm. The novel ends with a scene of a boatload of refugees in Venice Lagoon. And one of the things you're hinting at there is the extent to which a lot of contemporary political problems are all, in one way or another, matrices of the climate emergency.
Yes.
You think about the migrant crisis in Europe, those people fleeing Africa, many of them are fleeing climate emergency, unlivable conditions on the continent of Africa.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the sense in which politically we are absolutely in a period of the Anthropocene or some other era. Mm. I would call it the era of derangement. I mean, certainly when I wrote my book, I didn't really expect that these things would play out as fast as they are playing out. I mean, look, even 10 years ago, would you have said that the entire political structure of the Western world would be destabilized by a few hundred thousand migrants? If anyone had said that 10 years ago, nobody would have believed them. But that is what has happened. Actually, statistically insignificant number of people have completely upended, the political systems of the West. And, that is where we are now. And you may be absolutely sure that from this point onwards, things are only going to get worse. That's the one thing we know for sure about the world today, that this is just the beginning. Mm. The ways in which our political systems are being upended is irreversible. We are in an era when we don't know, what is next.
We are, as you say, in the era of derangement. And you talked earlier about how the novel struggles with representing or presenting the improbable. And it reminded me, and we're living in an era of political improbabilities as much as anything, reminded me of a famous remark, which I'm sure you know, that something Philip Roth, the great American novelist, said in 1960. He said that the problem for the American novelist is that American reality is always outdoing whatever the novelist's imagination can come up with. It's throwing up figures more lurid and grotesque than the novelist could ever imagine. And of course, contemporary politics is throwing up exactly these sorts of figures. I mean, one only has to look at the current inhabitant of the White House, for example.
Or what's been happening in Britain of late. That's... to me, and I think to many of us, really, many people around the world, I mean, Britain, after all, was the gold standard of stability. Stability, rationality, reason, the Enlightenment government, which trafficking in a certain kind of politics. The speed with which this, those assumptions have been overturned, it's uncanny, nothing short of uncanny, And again, as I say, we know that there's no turning back. I mean, this is a unidirectional thing. It's only going to get worse from now on.
We'll bring the audience in a minute, but just to end, you've talked about this era of derangement and political disruption on a scale we couldn't have imagined 10 years ago, but do you see any signs for hope? I mean, you mentioned Extinction Rebellion, which was remarkably effective in pushing the question of climate change up the political agenda in a relatively short space of time, and the green surge in the European elections across Europe just this weekend.
Those are wonderful things. I mean, absolutely. I think in 2018, some sort of corner was turned, honestly. Mm. People suddenly awoke to the reality that is unfolding around us suddenly. But the thing we have to remember is that the same set of facts can create two completely different sets of responses. You know, the same an awareness of the disaster that's ahead could, on the one hand, you know, propel you to say, well, we need greater justice in the world, we need to be more accommodating towards refugees, we need to do this and that. Or it could propel you to say, we need to have a lifeboat response, we need to seal off our borders, lots of people need to die, and there'll be an automatic self-correction once we have a Malthusian event, a Malthusian mega event, and that'll solve the crisis on its own. And, you know, you just have to look around the world to see which version is people are adopting. You know?
Let's bring in the audience. Can I make the ritual plea that you ask a question rather than deliver a speech? We'll go. There is a mic, I think. Gentleman here, and then I'll come to you.
Amitith, thank you very much for your observation. I disagree with your conclusion. Art is always, there's a couple of exceptions, but it always reflects, it's the litmus paper of what's going on. And you may say to me, well, in that case, what does that mean? And I go back to a word you may know, it's called mojita. It comes from a little Papuan Papua New Guinea island. It's only in this tribe. And it's a word they have, which is called the truth we know, but we will not talk about. I think art is, I'd like to hear your view, sorry, a question is, don't you think that art in a way is reflecting what is exactly going on? We don't want to talk about not only climate change. We talked this morning in a news conference about the end of economic growth. Economic growth ended in 2000. What you see nowadays is debt-induced. We are at a standstill. The world is reflecting that. The art is reflecting that. Any thoughts on that?
You know, I think that's such an interesting observation. You're absolutely right. I think that is such an interesting observation. But it's an observation that I, as a writer, find very hard to reconcile with, if you like, my own delusions or illusions or hopes about my practice. You know, which is that I would not be captive toward, to ruling ideologies or whatever. I would not be captive to the blindness that's thrust upon us. So, yes, I think that's a very interesting observation. You're absolutely right that let's face it, what the art world has become today is just a giant money laundering scheme. You know, we all know that.
Just here.
Thanks very much. That's most interesting. Can you say whether the governments locally or nationally in India are doing anything to protect those towns and cities that are lying beneath the sea level? And secondly, will praying to a god give us salvation from what's to come?
The first part is easier to answer. You know, in my book, in my last book, The Great Derangement, I actually started sketching, I sketched a scenario of one of the predicted impacts of climate change is that it'll create more cyclones in the Arabian Sea. And it seems very likely that at some point, one of these cyclones will hit Mumbai. And Mumbai, as you know, because your ancestors built this city, or you probably don't know, it's an estuarine city. It was six islands, which they've joined together. By putting in lots of reclamation stuff. But Mumbai is incredibly vulnerable to sea level rise and to climate change. So I began to think, what if a super cyclone hits Mumbai? And actually, the more I looked into it, the more terrifying the prospect became. Because, one of the things that protected New York during Hurricane Sandy is that New York does have these outer islands. Mumbai is just this stretch of reclaimed land facing a sea that goes all the way to Antarctica, And a storm surge depends on the length of the fetch, as they call it, which is how far the cyclone travels. So it would be driving before it a very, very high storm surge. Mumbai is responsible for like 50% of India's economy. Most of India's exports go through Mumbai. It's the center of the Reserve Bank, of the main stock exchange, and Even more worrying, Mumbai is the only city in the world which sits between two major nuclear installations. So, you know, the more I thought about this scenario, the more it terrified me. So I started looking into this and inquiring, is there a plan? Has anyone been thinking about this? And the answer is no, absolutely no. So, you know, one of the good things that came of writing The Great Derangement is that it set off a whole project now headed by Columbia University, where they're looking into this and creating disaster evacuation procedures and so on. So I do feel that I've contributed a little bit to the world in that way. But the rest of the country, you know, it's a mixed picture. I mean, along the East Coast, authorities have become very good at taking evacuations, you know. But at the same time, you know, what we are actually seeing, recent catastrophes in India, is this intermeshing of climate impacts and very bad planning, you know. It's the same kind of thing as happened in Houston during Hurricane Harvey. You know, they've built over floodplains and they've changed the natural drainage of the land in disastrous ways. So when there is a bad rain bomb event, for example, places get absolutely flooded. So, yeah, I mean, one can't say that there's been that much preparation. That is one aspect of climate change that people can address and prepare for, you know, and that is not really being done in India. The second question, well, you know, Martin Heidegger, the German philosopher, said as far back as 1964 that only a god can save us now.
There was a question at the back.
Hi, my name is Sagar. My question is based on a lot of the research I've been doing. So you said the issues of climate change are going to get worse. I've seen the attention and the awareness on one issue just skyrocket in the last few months, but it's not given or heeded any attention in terms of climate change or the impacts. So this is connected to technology, and we've been warned a lot by institutes over the last few years. You know, don't get addicted to your phone, it's going to be addictive, there's going to be issues. Now in the last few months, there's a lot of medical research, clinicologists, endocrinologists, who are actually talking about the huge impact, not just on the individual or the animal, but also on the environment. And I'm specifically referring to our progression, or maybe our digression, from 4G internet technology to 5G, which is basically radiation. Now, the question I have is, are we going to be that, pardon my French, but are we going to be that stupid, that we're not going to look at the implications on the environment and us, and we're going to say, okay, we need to do something for climate change. We're not going to look at the most prevalent issue. If anyone reads the tabloids for the last few months, it's going everywhere, and people are actually asking, what is the strength of these masts, the smart meter technology? Very quickly, frequency of this technology is much more than that of oxygen. When this technology goes beyond 30 degrees, which is the minimum, it is going beyond the 2 degrees that we're worrying about. So my question is that, are we ready to have a conversation about the most icky subject, which is 5G radiation, and is that the sign of our progress? Or are we actually going to stay within the cauldrons of there's only one solution, there's only one problem? Thank you.
Technology and climate change.
Climate change reflects, really, it reflects the acceleration of the world in multiple different ways, including technology, you know what I mean? And that acceleration manifests itself in so many different ways. For example, a lot of the migratory flows that you're seeing around the world today is completely linked to information technology. Mm-hmm. You know, so the technology is inseparable from climate change, from the general sort of acceleration that we're seeing around us. But again, as the gentleman said over there, what is the sort of total effect of all this technology, even of all the information that we have? It would seem that we've really chosen to say, no, we're not going to look at that. We're going to look at something else. We're going to look at pretty pictures on our phone.
Can I just what has just been said and what you've just said reminds me of the end of the novel. I've got this group of refugees in Venice Lagoon, and you draw the narrator draws this, a distinction between the coolies of the imperial age and modern refugees. So you write, nor had I or any of the young migrants I met been transported across continents in order to become cogs in some giant plantation-like machine that existed in order to serve the desires of others. That's the imperialist system. Now, just as much as anyone else, young men like Rafi Tipu and Bilal, the refugees, wanted those very things, smartphones, computers, cars. How could they not? So there's that nexus of technology, migration, and, as you say, climate change.
You'll see that in all reporting on migration, the phrase that always crops up is, I want a better life. What is a better life, you know? These are the things that a better life has come to mean. So underneath it all, as Pope Francis so movingly said in Laudato Si, is really the question of a good life. This is ultimately not an economic problem, it's not a technological problem, it's the question that lies at the heart of it is that, what is a good life?
There's a question at the front here, and then I'll come to you two at the back.
You made a very interesting point about the distinction between the human voice and the non-human voice, and were suggesting that that you don't find the non-human voice being heard in fiction. I'd be really interested in your further observations about the distinction, indeed the separation of these two voices, and whether or not you see any prospect of them coming together. And whether or not you think the same absence of the non-human voice in fiction is also perhaps at the root of some of the issues that we have in the non-fiction domain.
Well, you know, obviously when we speak of voice, it begs the question of, you know, in what does voice manifest itself? Because certainly we all know that animals have voices, you know, they can make certain sounds and so on. But, you know, beyond that really rises the question of when does a voice rise to the level of speech or rise to the level of, you know, manifesting agency. Now, we do know, because of nonfiction, because of what scientists have been showing us, that trees especially have very extensive systems of communication. They can do lots of things for each other. They act to defend their young. They can send carbon to their children. They do all sorts of things. I mean, all sorts of very complex things. You know, they undertake these very complex maneuvers. So there again, the question is, obviously, they're communicating. You know, what are they communicating? You know, how are they communicating? We just don't know. You know, just as trees seem mute to us, we may seem mute to trees, you know. How do we know that trees don't make their own history? How do we know that we are not being gardened by trees? No, really, you think about it, of a great sort of, the great Malthusian die-off will be wonderful for trees. All those dead bodies to feed on, you know.
There are two questions at the back. Let's take them together, because we're running out of time, and I might try and come to you at the front.
Yes, which?
So there were two questions at the back. Sorry, can we take them together if we make them quick?
Thank you very much. You argue, Amitabh, I'm here.
Ah.
That, I'll stand up.
Yes.
That there is not much utility in personal action, but I would like to challenge that. I think that an effort to reduce a personal carbon footprint teaches any individual a number of things. That it is very difficult, that it is intimately connected with how we live and how we consume, and that although I agree with you about the challenge of the rise of Asia, relatively speaking, personal carbon emissions remain higher in developed countries per capita than they do in Asia. All of those understandings, I think, are essential to creating the politics that we need for climate change and giving permission to politicians to take the scale of action that we require. So I think the two are related, and that it is unfortunate to dismiss the personal effort. Would you like to comment?
And then let's just take... there was a question behind. Was there someone behind you? And if we can just take that, and then we'll do them together.
Hi, my name is Dee. I'm from Lebanon, and it was really lovely to hear you speak. I called my mother at Easter to wish her happy Easter when we were having a heat wave here in London. And Lebanon is a very hot country. Usually it's about 42 degrees at Easter. And my mother tells me that it was snowing in Beirut. And I said to her, it's climate change. And my mother echoed the sentiment of millions of people in my country. And she said, no, it's the wrath of God. It's not climate change. Now, I'm an artist, I'm a writer, and when I took my, I'm very passionate about climate change and the shift of consciousness that's happening, and when I took my ideas to publishers in Beirut, I was told, don't be ridiculous, you have to write about things that people want to read about. So for somebody who comes from a culture that is doesn't quite echo the kind of the awareness that you have here in the West, how do you propose for an artist like me who wants to be heard in their community to talk about issues that people dismiss as the wrath of God?
So should we do the first question first? So there was a question about the inseparability, forgive me if I'm distorting what you said, the inseparability of personal responsibility, personal action, and collective political will.
See, this is absolutely the Protestant ideology. So it doesn't surprise me that it's a popular one here. Change your carbon footprint if you like, and you know that'll give you a sense of virtue, and that's good. That's great. The most important thing you can do, but you must remember that the only genuinely sustainable lifestyle, really, is that of a farmer in Bangladesh or Ethiopia. Tell me, honestly, you think you can live like a Bangladeshi or an Ethiopian? I think you should undertake this. You should. It's good to feel good, you know. So we should feel better about ourselves and what we do. I mean, absolutely, I agree. But how can a personal decision... I can't... If I want to solarize my house, there has to be a public grid to which I can link myself up, doesn't there? So those decisions we can't take individually. Those decisions have to be taken, through political means. So yes, it's wonderful that you want to shrink your carbon footprint, but you must remember that the most important thing you can do, really, in the end, is to do what Greta Thunberg is doing and what Extinction Rebellion is doing. You know, only in those ways will we get the mass adjustments that can actually create changes at scale, you know? So the second question is?
The second question, what advice do you have for an artist who is faced with the task of trying to persuade people who think that climate change is merely the wrath of God, that it's actually something that threatens our very existence on this planet?
But let me say here that what I'm saying should not be taken as an encouragement for you to expand your personal footprint. Obviously not. I don't mean that by any means. And I do feel that we must all try to learn to live. I grew up in a city, Calcutta, where we would have, a week-long power cuts. So I've lived through that. And I can tell you that I think you would find that very, very difficult. The wrath of God, yes. Look, I think to feel that it's the wrath of God at least gives you the awareness of our vulnerability, you know? And that's the sort of awareness that has been missing for a very long time. We felt that we were completely in control, and we are not. You know, there are other actors in this world that surround us. And your mother chooses to give to those other actors the name of God, you know? But at least there is an awareness that, you know, we are facing perils of a kind that are not just available to us through techniques of reason, if you like.
I fear I'm going to have to apologize to the people here because we are almost out of time. Thank you all for coming and for your penetrating questions. Amitav will be signing copies of Gun Island and I think some of your other books in the foyer outside, so there'll be an opportunity to maybe pose a question while he signs the book, if you'd like to pick up your own copy and say hello there. The last thing for me to do is to ask you to join me in thanking him for a great session. Thank you, Amitav.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews, and animations.